Okay, good morning, guys. I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic, and thank you all for being here. As most of you know, I'm a member of the Men Who Trudge group. I'm the anniversary and membership chair for my home group. We've got a sponsor. I'm involved in service at the Area 50 level currently. I'm our alternate chairperson for the treatment committee. I enjoy doing that, although that position is going to be up shortly in January 1st. We're changing panels, but I'm going to hope to be our next Men Who Trudge group GSR. That's my next on my list for service opportunities. So I enjoy that, and I'm grateful to be here speaking. It's a little bit weird to speak at my own home group meeting, the one that I bugged so many people. Or I guess I don't bug them. I give people the opportunity to spread the message through doing this. It's really important, and I'm really humbled. I was able to speak at a meeting 2 or 3 Sundays ago. It was down in Salamanca. For anyone not from this area, it's about an hour and a half or so south of Buffalo. And it was their 79th group anniversary. It was pretty cool. We had a hour dinner firsthand and whatever. So anytime I'm asked to speak, not only because I'm a speaker meeting, but because those, not only because I'm a speaker seeker, but because those who've come before me have told me how important it is to say yes when I'm asked to do something Alcoholics Anonymous. If the answer is no, I should have a real good reason to say no. That's me personally, you know, and that's what I've been instructed by my sponsor and sponsors in the past, and I believe in that. So that's what brings us here today to this moment, and I'm coming to you from Buffalo, New York, like many people on the meeting are, but not all of us. We've got people from Canada and all around the East Coast and Southeastern United States and whatnot. So I live here in downtown Buffalo, born and raised. My plan here, just so that you know, I said the set-aside prayer. I invite our speakers to say the set-aside prayer, lead us through that the day they speak. That's why I did that today. And I think that's important because it gives me an opportunity to allow God to direct what's going to come out of my mouth. Because if I wake up at 7 o'clock like I did on a Sunday morning, and this meeting's not until 10, and football's not until 1, and I got way too much time to think of stuff and start to make notes and cue cards, and you guys don't need that. You need the language that comes from my heart, which is hopefully the direction that this goes. So I'm glad I said the set-aside prayer before. And but you know what I plan to do, and I don't speak all that often, but what I do, I try to spend not too much time, but some time on what it used to be like. Hopefully the least amount of time on that, and also on what happened. And then when I talk about what it's like now, I usually, if we have the time, I'll have to be my own spiritual timekeeper here, but I usually go through each of the 12 steps during that last portion, I guess. So anyway, born in Buffalo. I'm 59 now, so I was born in 66, and grew up in South Buffalo. I'll make a lot of Buffalo references because that's where I'm from, and I understand a lot of you guys aren't and you know aren't really familiar. But I find that the more I identify in this program with people, that we can be polar opposites in every single facet of our life, and socioeconomically and religiously and racially and all other stuff. But the thoughts and feelings, at least in my experience, are always the exact same. Always, you know. So when I make references to my hometown, that's just because that's where I grew up and whatnot. But so I grew up in South Buffalo, and you know, a heavy Irish Catholic. I'm Italian, but Irish Catholic. I'm actually not Italian. I'm a European mutt. My last name's Italian. I'm a quarter English, a quarter Irish, a quarter German, and a quarter Italian. But you know, grew up in this, yeah, not tough neighborhood, but it was a blue collar neighborhood. And we like to go out and cause trouble. And my parents, I've got a brother and 4 sisters, and my parents were never big drinkers, especially when I was growing up. My mom grew to have a little bit of an issue with alcohol later on in her life, but they weren't big drinkers. I've never seen my dad drunk a day in his life. Glass of wine here and there, but that was it. And that wasn't my story. You know, a lot of my friends' parents were pretty good drinkers, you know. So the first drink I ever had is where I'll start. And one of the reasons I know that I'm in an alcoholic, that I'm alcohol, I suffer from the disease of alcoholism, and I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous right now, and that's the right place for me, is because drugs are a part of my story. But alcohol has been my love. You know, when it came time, when I had 10 bucks left, it was a cheap bottle of whiskey. It was not a joint or a bag or a rock or any of that kind of stuff, although that was part of my story. But it was alcohol, you know. And so I think I was 12, and there's a lot of stuff about my life. A big part of my drinking career was a blackout drinker, and starting young and continuing on through most of my life. And so there's a lot of my life I don't remember, like years at a time. I know where I was, I know where I live, but I've like lost these massive amounts of memory, and one of the prices that I pay. But my first drink, I remember everything about it. I remember where I was, who I was with, my buddy Mike in his basement, his parents and another couple were upstairs playing Jim Rummy. A case of, it was an old Mr. Boston case in their basement of assorted liquor bottles. And this was back in the 70s. And the liquor bottles had these white paper caps with red writing over the top. It was a tax stamp that showed that there were taxes paid on that. And I remember that. I remember the bottles that were in that case. I didn't even know what any of them were. It's the first time I've ever drank, but there was a bottle of J&B Scotch, and what we drank was gin, Beefeaters, and we took it out and we drank it straight out of the bottle. And again, I remember everything. I remember how it made me feel, and I'm saying all this because I've asked a lot of people in my life what they remember about their first drink, and most people, especially non-alcoholics, say, "Huh, I don't really know. You know, I probably had a beer in high school, maybe my junior prom. Like, there's just no recollection of it." And for me, it was this gigantic moment in my life where I matched the disease that was already brewing in me, the disease of selfishness and self-centeredness, found its mate. It found its symptom to go along with it, you know, and that was the alcohol. And right away, it started working, you know. And I can't say it made me taller and feel better and all that kind of stuff because I was never a ladies' man my whole life, and certainly not in high school. I was a late bloomer by those standards. But it allowed me to function, you know. It allowed me to get along with people and feel at least a little bit better about myself. I always loved lying. I was a little kid, 6 years old. My dad would I'd have to go pick up the papers and garbage on the front lawn. That was part of my thing for my allowance. And he'd come out, and we had all these big pine bushes around my house, and I'd kick all, rather than just picking them up, I'd kick all the shit under the all the papers, and there was an empty can on the lawn or something. People used to litter a lot more then, so not as big of a deal now. But I used to kick him under the bushes, and sure enough, he'd come out, and I'd say, "Well done." He'd come out and he'd check the bushes and, "Why'd you do that?" "No, I don't know, you know, whatever. I'm 6 years old." And my dad was an attorney. He was always very logical. He'd say, "You know, it would have been way less time if you just picked him up. Now you got to crawl under the bushes and pick him up. He didn't beat me and whip me and that kind of stuff, but he made me feel like, oh yeah, you know, what a dummy." But that idea of lying started when I was really young. I can remember that specifically. And I've always had this fascination with getting away with things, you know, so much so that I didn't mention this at the very beginning. My sobriety date is April 2nd, 2021, so a little over 4 years ago. And the first time I came in the program, I came in 2000, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. And I racked up some good sobriety, so many years, you know, over double digit years sobriety, and it eventually went back out. But you know, this time around, it was in 2021 that I came in, and that desire to get away with things just pervaded my entire life. And that was it was everything from getting my allowance without doing the work to being good at sports, and then once I wasn't, I'd quit the sport instead of doing the work. Things that didn't come easy to me, it had to come easy. I had to get away with it. I saw other people working at it. Now that's not for me. No way. So that's just a part of my makeup. That's that selfishness and self-centeredness. That's how it rears its head in me. You know, it just let me take the easy way out. So anyway, fast forward a little bit. So that's 12, and we were drinking every weekend and sometimes during the week, and you'd find buyers then. You'd stand outside a store with 10 bucks in your hand, and some stranger would walk by. "Hey, will you buy for me?" "Yeah, what do you want? A case of Jenny." And like the fact that that's the world we grew up in, it blows my mind today. I'd want to punch someone if they did that, but that's my story. And then through, you know, in through high school, I again, this idea of getting away with stuff. It could be anything from cheating on a test, or it could be anything from getting a paycheck and a job when I was a dishwasher in high school. I instead of washing some of the dishes, we used to throw them in the dumpster. You'll hear about this. I spent my life as a chef. I used to throw the equipment in the dishwasher because I didn't want to wash it because I wanted to go out drinking with my friends. And we were allowed to drink in the kitchen there at 16 anyway. So just that whole idea of getting away with things. I've been skydiving, and it's the absolute thrill of landing and beating death, this sickness. And I'm bringing it up a lot now because when I go through the steps, a lot of what I'm able to recognize today is motives, what's going on in my life. But anyway, so going up through high school, that's kind of the way it goes. And I don't have, I can't, there's no one I can blame for my alcoholism. There's no one I want to blame, but there's no one specific trauma or anything like that. I had a reasonably normal childhood. And when I was a senior in high school, I don't know, it was right before, right after graduation, I got my first DUI. I'd rack a couple more up over the time, but I got my first one then. And there was very little consequences. I mean, there were some, but it was different then. And it was different in the 70s than it was in the 80s. It's certainly different now than it was back then. But I had to go to one AA meeting by the court, and I think I might have lost my license for a few months. But right away I went away to college right after that, when I and that was when I really felt freedom. The freedom to really to drink alone. I would drink with friends too, but now I've got a dorm room and eventually an apartment, and always worked, always had some sort of income so I could buy my own booze. And it started taking off then. I don't realize that I'm learning life, walking forward, learning life, looking backwards, but I didn't realize that's when it really started taking off. Nightly drinking, of course, other drugs and things like that. Nightly drinking, daily drinking, started drinking during the day, finish up in a 2-year college, a small private college in the Adirondack Mountains, and I moved down to Miami, Florida, to finish up my 4-year degree. The school I went to was only a 2-year college at the time. And now it's the 80s and I'm in Miami, and I'm an alcoholic. I know I've got a problem with alcohol. I already had a DUI. The idea about powerlessness, I don't, knowing that I'm powerless doesn't keep me from drinking, but I don't argue with the fact that I'm powerless. Like, I think I knew that when I got that DUI in my heart. I think my heart was like, you got a problem with alcohol. I didn't know that once I was going to try to stop, that I wasn't going to be able to, because I never tried before. I never tried for a line or anything like that. I didn't understand that, but I did understand that I had a problem with alcohol and had a pretty good hold on me. So now I'm in Miami, and now you can fuel me up with some of the dry goods and the white stuff that is still floating around everywhere today. But in the 80s, there was no shortage of that in Miami. And I thought I was Don Johnson. I'm going to school a couple days a week. I'm tending bar, making a ton of money tending bar. I got a mullet, I got the lot like Don Johnson. I'd wear a t-shirt with a sport coat over it like him, and it's such a joke. I was just a little white punk down there, causing trouble and whatever. I've always been in the service industry. I've been a chef. I've been involved in restaurants and hotels my entire life in one facet or another, and it's always been in the food and beverage side of it. I haven't always been a chef, but I've always been involved in restaurants and bartending, waiting, managing, all of that sort of stuff. And so I'm, making money, taking easy classes, and drinking and drugging. And I graduated, barely, but I graduated. And I moved back home. I had a little bit of a, well, I moved to St. Petersburg for a year, but then I moved back home, and nothing changed. These geographic relocations from Saranac Lake to Miami to St. Petersburg to Buffalo. My next one's going to be to California shortly, but that nothing changed. I come back home and I'm running with all my friends, and it seemed a lot more normal in the area I grew up with. You'd go out and you'd be hammered, plowed, smashed, at 4 in the morning, and the next day, I didn't get all that shame. Somebody would be like, "You were a mess last night. Everything okay today or whatever?" But from there, when I was in my mid-20s, I moved out to California to work, to be a chef with a buddy of mine at a restaurant out in the San Francisco Bay Area. And one of the first nights out there, I might have been 24 or 25. I go out with my buddy and his wife Linda at the bar right across from the restaurant we work at, and I do my usual thing. And the next, and this is my buddy Joe that I was running with in Miami and partying with nonstop. And the next day we wake up, he said, "Dude, what the fuck is wrong with you?" Excuse me, I didn't really mean to use that word, but that is what he said. I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, you were like stumbling. You couldn't even stand last night. I was like, dude, that's what we do. We did it every night in college. He said, yeah, we're not in college anymore, man. You know, it's time to grow up. And that was a good friend of mine. I still didn't know what an alcoholic was or anything like that, but I knew I couldn't stop. You know, so this behavior goes on, and I go on to work for Marriott Hotels, work at a great hotel, and I start bottoming out. I'm getting into my 30s now, and I want to finish up this what it used to be like. I start bottoming out, and it gets to the point where some friends of mine, that buddy I just mentioned, but some other people called my dad and said, "We think your son's gonna die. You got to come out and get him." And my whole rest of my family's out in Buffalo, and at that point, this is important. At that point, I was still working, but I was about to walk out. I was just about to quit my job, and I had a little apartment with a lounge chair and a mattress on the floor, many tens of thousands of dollars in debt. I hadn't paid a credit card bill in years, and just a shambles of this darkness inside this little apartment with no lights on and dirty, and out front I had a Lincoln, a very sharp Lincoln Mark 7, a sports car, shiny, always shiny. That was the parallel for my life, you know. So long as you saw the Lincoln on the outside. So at work, a couple of weeks before they call my dad, they say, "Jim, we know you're having a problem. Why don't you go to rehab? You know, we have this thing called EAP, Employee Assistance Programs. Why don't you go to rehab? We'll hold your job." And I said, "Why don't you worry about your own problems? I'll take care of myself." 2 weeks later, phone call goes to my dad. "Come get your son." And my dad doesn't know what to do, so he actually calls. I believe the story is correct here. He calls Dave P, who's on this meeting. And my dad was attorney, Dave's attorney, who was involved with lawyers, helping lawyers, says, "Hey, my son's out in Buffalo or out in California. What do I do?" He said, "Go hop on a plane, go get him, bring him back here." And Dave and Don McHenry and a couple other people were sat in my living room with me and my dad and my mom, and I said I want to go to rehab. I didn't fight them. I think they were on a 12-step call. I think they were ready, you know, to tell their stories, and I was dead. I was broken. This is in 2000. This is in August of 2000. So I go to rehab in Pennsylvania, and really did well there. I enjoyed it. I came out of rehab. I stayed 28 days or 30 days, whatever. And I came out, and I put together like 2 years of sobriety pretty quickly. And then I drank, but I only drank once. I drank at a Bills game, actually. And then the very next day, or I think that was a Sunday, I think Tuesday, I went back to a meeting. And then after that, I was able to rack up, like I said, like about 12 years of sobriety up until 2014. And in that time, I met a wonderful woman, my late wife, which you'll hear about. And I went back to college. I became a instead of cooking, I became an instructor in culinary arts and hospitality management, a tenured professor, got my degree, and straightened my life out, you could say, you know. Buried my dad when he passed away, did his eulogy, executive of the state, and one of the things I was always most proud of was my wife. We got married in 2002, and 2 weeks, well, two or 3 weeks after our honeymoon, she was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, very serious, stage four, very serious, and she didn't pass away until 2023. We were married for 21 years, which was wonderful, but I started becoming her caregiver right away, and then I was sober. You know, she never saw me drunk. We met when I was sober. She never saw me take a drink, and I became her caregiver. And her whole life was not. She was not bedridden and sickly her entire life. She was a medical professional, had a wonderful career, but she was sick and very sick many, many times over those 21 years. Multiple hospitalizations and excuse me, all kinds of things from side effects from the chemo and radiation and whatnot. So I became her caregiver. That's actually one of the reasons I went into education, because I was running a restaurant when she relapsed in 05, her second time, and I knew I couldn't run the restaurant and be around for her and be at the. You just can't miss days all the time, you know? So I figured if I get into teaching, I'll have a steady schedule. I'll know my schedule a semester in advance. We can schedule our appointments around that. And by God's grace, that worked out. And I became very proud of being her caregiver, and we had a great life. As challenging as it was wonderful. Traveled and whatnot. And I came home one day in 2014 or 15. Well, before that, I had started this that those feelings of love and everything, the feelings of being a caregiver and unconditional love I was going to meetings at that point. You know, I said I was sober 12 years. I was going to meetings and a couple of meetings a week. You know, I nothing like today. Nothing like today. I was not going out with guys. I wasn't really involved in AA. I was in AA, but more around it than in it. I did a little bit of service. I was a group treasurer once, but and so I start getting these nagging feelings that I'm getting a little bit tired of this marriage. You know, I'm getting a little bit tired of all this shit. When is somebody going to take care of me? What about me? You know, what the fuck? I've been doing this shit for 12, 14 years. And I pretty quickly stopped going to meetings. I had a bag full of all my notebooks and 12 and 12 and whatever and threw it in the recycle bin and started drinking within a week of stopping going to meetings and kept it hidden for a little bit from my wife, my late wife. And, this idea of unconditional love and being a caregiver turned into a huge resentment. And instead of I'm proud to take care of my wife, I was, who does this bitch think she is to ruin my goddamn life? You know? And I had those same feelings towards God, you know? Screw you. Why are you doing this to me? Why are you giving my wife cancer to affect me? I'm sober and that's how I'm thinking. Or at least I'm not drinking and that's how I'm thinking, you know? And that's just a tough place to be. I don't wish that place on anybody. If anyone's been in that place, you probably know the result. You know, I went out and I figured it would be a little bit, like a month or two. And after a month or two, I actually meet a woman half my age, just about, and I come home drunk out of my mind in 2015, out of the blue on a Friday night. My wife thought I was working and told her I wanted a divorce, and we separated. For about 2 or 3 years, we got back together in 2018. I think it was 15, so 3 years we separated. And by God's grace, and I was a maniac that entire time. I was crazy. You know, I eventually would lose that tenured faculty position. And in 2018, I went crawling back to my wife on my hands and knees asking if we can get back together. And by God's grace, she said yes. She said yes, if you get sober. I said, I'm going to try. That was in 2018. I told you guys my sobriety date was 2021. So I did try. I didn't go to AA. You know, I knew it worked. So I guess I didn't try. I didn't try the right solution. You know, I tried to control my drinking, which I had done my whole life, but I knew AA worked and I'm out there dying. And it was extra hurtful because now we're living back together and whatnot. So anyway, let me just move this along. So one day in 2021, she says, you got to go to AA. You got to stop. I said, I'll call tonight. And I needed to get alcohol and I couldn't drive. And it was, I just couldn't, I was shaking too bad. I couldn't drive. And I said, if you take me to get alcohol, I'll call tonight. And she took me and I got alcohol and I drank it all day and all night. And she said, when are you going to call? And I said, call who? And she reminded me. And by only, again, by God's grace, I did pick up the call. That was in January of 21. It took me until April, but I picked up the call and some people on this meeting said, join Men Who Trudge. It's a Zoom meeting. And that was in the middle of COVID. Just thought I had lost my mom just weeks before that and whatever. It was tough. And I got in here, you know, by God's grace. And my, like I said, my wife would end up, we ran a little business together for 2 years. And then she passed in 2023. And then COVID hit. And we sold the business, which we thought was the worst thing ever. But we didn't know that she was going to pass away. In 2023, so we got to spend the last 2.5 years of our life side by side together, every minute of every day. And before she passed, I got to make my ninth step against her, and that was critically important. And I got to be there and carry out her wishes, her final wishes, which weren't mine. You know, I didn't want to pull the damn plug, but that's what she wanted. And as I stood there, surrounded by family and friends with. Which was her wish too, with 20 of us in the room. And she took her last breath. And if you would have asked me if I wanted to be there for that, I would have said, no, I'll be in the waiting room. You know, come and get me a minute afterwards. And that was one of the most precious moments of my life, to be sober and holding my wife's hand while she took her last breath. It was incredibly powerful. Incredibly. I felt the presence of God, which I do believe in. I do have a higher power, but I felt the presence of God. And one way I describe it is, I'm no contractor. I'm a chef. I'm a cook, you know. But when they do that spray foam insulation, I think that stuff is so cool. All of a sudden, it, like they spray it on, it goes, and that's what the room felt like as she took her last breath. It felt just filled. Every ounce of oxygen or whatever just became God. It was really, really cool. You know, 2 hours later, I'm sitting at the funeral home, planning her funeral wake and that kind of stuff. Like it was heavy, but I got to be there, you know, and that's thanks to this program and you guys and the people that held me up at that time, which obviously I needed a lot of holding up, you know. So that was beautiful. And to spend those last two and a half years, like literally on the couch side by side watching TV and reading the big book and praying, and it was a miracle, an absolute complete total miracle. So that takes you up to me getting back here in 2021. And since I've been back here, even while my wife was still alive, before we lost her, I started getting busier in AA. I started working the steps. I'm going through the steps for my, for, well, really my third time in 4 years. Fourth, but the first time I sort of half-assed it. But, you know, I believe really in the big book is a textbook. That it's a solution to the problem that we all suffer from, and certainly I do, and that the steps are the implementation of that solution. They point out the problem, they tell us there's a solution, then they give us a plan of action to implement that solution, and they tell us that in the big book. The Joe and Charlie tapes have been very instrumental for me this time around. I feel like it explains things in a almost a grammar school level, which is what I need when it comes to this book, even though I read it over and over again. So I want to talk a little bit about the steps and what they meant for me as I finish up here. And excuse me just 1 second, guys. I'm just going to get another tissue. Hopefully I won't have any more waterworks. I knew it was coming with my wife, but give me just 20 seconds here. Not even. Hello. Okay, thank you for bearing with me through that. That's the language of the heart there. So through the steps, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Our lives had become unmanageable. I didn't have a problem with the powerlessness part, but I didn't talk about it. But in California, I'd racked up 2 more DUIs for a total of 3. After my third one, I had the taxi driver, when they ROR'd me the next day, I had him take me straight to the liquor store. I never even thought about, you know, and then I had to go back into counseling and more AA meetings and that. This and that. But so I admitted I was powerless. You just had to look at my track record, really. A judge could have handed a file folder over full of my powerlessness over alcohol, or at least proof of that. But my life being unmanageable, you know, I came in here and I stopped drinking, and my life became manageable. Even with my wife's illnesses and stuff, I was able to do things and make appointments, and I thought I was managing things. I didn't understand that part of it. You know, I wasn't drinking, so I was like, well, God's taking care of the drinking. And everything else is going okay. So, you know, what are we worried about here? Let's move on to step two. And in step two, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I was not falling down the stairs anymore. I wasn't pissing my pants. I wasn't getting DUIs. So I thought I'd been restored to sanity. I thought that was the insanity they were talking about, was the silly alcoholic things that were, or the disgusting and sick alcoholic things that we do when we're drunk. But I've come to believe now that that's not the insanity. When I relapsed back in 15, I think push came to shove with life with me, and I didn't have a mental defense and against that first drink, and I didn't have a relationship with my higher power, and my mind was telling me, just take a goddamn drink, dude. It's worked your whole life. What's the matter? It's not going to be that bad. You haven't drank in a while. I think that's the insanity that they're talking about that, and I didn't really understand that. So I moved forward in the past with this third step. Turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, as we understood. I mean, yeah, sure, everything's working out fine right now. At that point, when I first took these steps, I didn't, the God, as I understood him, I was still trying to mend a relationship with this God of my youth that hated me. And to be honest, I hated as well. It was a hate relationship. This person in a beard on a cloud with a lightning bolt and a staff, and he had already had my number. He knew it. I'd done it all. I grown up the way I grew up. I'd broken all the rules. I was definitely going to hell. So I got sober and stayed sober for a while, but I never changed that relationship. I never created a God as I understood him. And this time around, I was listening to the Serenity Improvement Group, which is a Tuesday, Saturday Zoom meeting that has some. It's a out of it's a national or international meeting, but has a couple hundred people on it. It's got some great speakers, and they had a guy named Ali speaking from Toronto, Canada, and he talked about deleting his old God and creating a new God of love and compassion and devotion and friendship and all that. And I was like, huh, I'm going to do that. This is about 2 or 3 years ago. I was driving on Southwestern Boulevard. It's like a white light moment. I'm going to do that. And I created a new version of a higher power, a softer, gentler version that is inside of me and that it loves me. And we wake up together every morning. Hey, what are we going to do today together? That a different thing than, oh God, this God's got my number. I got to go out and impress him to make up for what I've done. It's a different relationship with a different power today, And I use the word God, and it's really like Mark uses the word Father of Light sometimes. Like I don't have an issue with any of the spiritual definitions, but I understand that some people do, So when I talk about God, I try to be cognizant of that, And in these first two steps that I'm talking about, three now, they especially in the first step, when you're reading about it in the book, it just talks about the hopelessness, the hopelessness and the insanity. Like that's what it sets us up for. And like over and over again, I'm in a step action group now and going through it a different way. And I'm like, holy shit, it's right there in the book. Like it's really literally we're insane. It tells us exactly what it is, but I still need to be walked through that. And the same thing with that third step. The way I understand it today is, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of a God. Made a decision to turn our instead of will and lives, I say, made a decision to turn our thoughts and actions over to the care of a God of our understanding. Thoughts and actions just defines it a little bit better for me than will and lives. And I say a prayer every morning where as part of my morning prayer and meditation, I say a prayer every morning that goes, I apologize over alcohol and everything in my life is unmanageable by me and I need to be restored to sanity and I'm turning my thoughts and actions over to your care today. Please help me. That's those first three steps. I'm not saying I take them and whatever. I also say the third step prayer and seventh step prayer, but I remind myself of those first three steps every day. And four and five, four I just read is like walking into not a haunted house, but an old house and an old estate that hasn't been lived in 20 years, and it's full of cobwebs and spider webs and sheets on the furniture, and you can't see out the windows. And five is opening the doors and airing it out and taking the sheets off the furniture and cleaning the windows out. And I like analogies, and it was kind of a cool simplified way to do it. The things I know about all the steps that I'm learning, relearning again, is that I used to look at them as individual, more like stepping stones, like as individual columns. And going through with this group I'm going through now, we're just on the second step, about to do the third. And I'm seeing how it's not like that. And the writers of the book are setting us up. And again, I'm not stupid, but I just didn't. I don't know what I don't know, and one of the gifts today is being able to admit that. But it's flowing us step by step through this process. So by the time we're done with four, we're if I'm willing, like that's all I need to do in these beginning steps, especially one through three, is this willingness. Believe you're willing. If I'm willing to do that, then I can move forward. I write four. If it's not perfect, I go through it with my sponsor, somebody on five, and you just feel different. You feel like you did something finally. At least that was my experience. I could start to look myself in the mirror again. It didn't feel good when I wrote down in there. The way I treated my wife, those especially those couple of years when we were back together before I got sober, Please don't drink today. I'm not going to drink. Let me just go to Wegmans and grab some groceries. And what did I do, guys? You know the answer. Came home loaded. Almost not even able to speak. All of it. It's horrendous, but that's okay. Part of forgiveness is I tell someone else in front of them and God, and it's off my. That's it. It's all I got to do. Share my sin with one other person and God. And then I've got some work to do. Good thing we didn't stop at step five. I've still got some work to do. But on six and seven, again, my first time around versus this time, six and seven, you guys know this if you've been through the steps. In the big book, it's only two paragraphs. So how important can they be? Of course, I thought that. Again, I'm no dummy. How important can they be? But in the 12 and 12, man, they're two very, very intense chapters. And six and seven, it's just a continue. Like I'm again, here's where it's flowing in. I thought it, they were separate silos from four and five. I can see four and five being, but six, seven, I thought they were separate silos. Here's me starting to look at my part. That was that fourth column. It's okay. You admit you did have a part now. Let's see about that. Let's just talk about that. Let's explore about that. Let's have a journey of healing about that. It's not a stick, it's not flogging myself anymore by this point. It's let's shed some more light on this. It's starting to work here. So anyway, I thought they were nothing because they're in there. So I didn't think I had to do anything, just maybe say the seventh step prayer in the morning, and that was enough. But in one of my step action groups, or one way I went through the steps, when we got to six and seven, specifically six, but what we made we didn't make it. It's in a workbook. There's a list of all these negative feelings and actions and whatever, selfishness, dishonesty, you name it, greed. There's 25 things out here, 26 things out here. And the exercise is rank them all and like zero or one, that then that defect doesn't bug you on a daily basis. The closer you get to 10, it means that that's really in your craw, So for me, sloth and laziness has always been a big part. I shared that earlier on. I'll take the easy way out all the time. Those were high up there. And like greed for me, or envy for me, is much more higher than greed, because I want what you have. I'm not, greed is like, I'm going to put my family aside and go work for it and forget everybody else and go get what I want. I just want what you have. I want to take what you have. I don't want to work for it. So envy's up there, etc. And then opposite that is the opposite action. And then the numbers that you score 7 through 10, you circle those and make a little list. And then you look at the opposite actions. And then the following days, you start to practice those opposite actions. So six and seven are not passive, they're active. It's not just, God, you take away what is going to stand between you and I today. It's active. What's in my craw, and what's the opposite behavior? And let me go and practice that. Let me go and practice that. Eight and nine, again, I won't get too much into it, but thank God I got to be able to go through a ninth step with my wife before we lost her. I'll say that about it, and don't delay. I'm glad I didn't delay. I don't know if I could have accepted that, but in 10, 11, and 12, as I wrap up here, continue to take personal inventory when we're wrong, probably admit it. Doing the steps once a year or so, like, this, I know this is talking about daily inventory, but my fourth step doesn't have anyone on it, or very few people on it. And the more I do this 10 step, I gotta make amends when I have to make amends. But the list gets shorter. That's from my perspective, is the more I go through this and ask myself at the end of the night, was I a taker or a giver? That's what it boils down to. A taker or giver. And it's also boils down to this idea of, by this point, inventory isn't always in the red, but by this point, I get to recognize that I did something today. I might have been nice to somebody yesterday, whatever it might be. What did I add to this stream of life? Self-reflection is a good thing. Self-reflection isn't self-deprecation. It's not self-destruction. It's been going on for thousands of years. And it's, let me look inside myself to see if I can grow a little bit. That's really cool. In 11 and 12, I didn't know much about meditation, prayer and meditation especially. So I started a prayer process, and I changed that up once in a while because I get kind of in a rut with it. In meditation, I went on our Wednesdays on this group, we have a meditation meeting, and we start with meditation, and that was being helpful to me, but I wasn't really feeling it. And people used to ask me when I was a chef, hey, how do I learn how to cook? And I would say, I would be a dick about it. I'd say, take goddamn cooking classes. How do you think you learn how to cook? You know, don't watch TV. Take cooking classes. Go with professionals. So I started taking meditation classes. I was able to take my own advice, you know, and I've been doing those for over a year now, and it's made a big difference in my it's made a big difference in my blood pressure, I'll tell you that, but it made a difference in my life. This idea of a two-way win-win situation with my higher power and me asking, me listening, him asking, sending his will. I'm just a conduit. It's all flowing through me. It really makes a peaceful. I had to miss a class yesterday because my brother and sister were visiting, and I only see them a couple times a year. So I can meditate on my own. I don't have to go to a class. I try to make it a daily practice, and it's very helpful. Very helpful. Anyone ever had questions on it or anything, I'd be more than willing to work with you. A little bit of practice. That's one of those things. A little bit of practice. Those things that I w refuse to practice on goes a long way. And I'm 12. You know, I'm carrying the message now, and that first half, I like involved being in service, but I really like the second half of practicing these principles in all of our affairs. This meeting is going to end in 4 minutes or whatever, in all of our affairs. So, yes, in AA, pick up the phone, all those kind of things. Carry the message, tell my story, be a proper representation of sobriety and whatnot. But also in the grocery store and with my family and with friends and stuff like that. Be a decent person. It's not that difficult. The spiritual experience at the end of all of this that I've come up with, you know, it's happened to me not in a white light moment, but it's been growing, you know, as I go. And it's this culmination of all these little sparks, I guess we'll call them. But what I've learned and come to believe through all of this, and again, thanks to many people in this meeting and to Bill and Bob and to my higher power and everyone, is that, in the 11th step prayer, the prayer of St. Francis, it is better to give than to receive. That's what I was looking for in every bottle and every broken relationship and every job and disaster and bankruptcy and everything. I was looking to learn the lesson that it's better to give than to receive. And that's all I learned in AA, but that's all I ever needed to learn. And it's one thing to learn it, but I keep doing it imperfectly, super imperfectly, but I keep doing it because that's what my heart wants. My Mark said once, I changed the way I thought about my higher power, and that changed the way I thought about life. And that's the interpretation of all of this stuff. So with that, I am going to close the meeting down in a minute. But first, I'm going to stop the recording, and I want to thank you guys so much for being here for me, and I'm glad I got the chance to tell you guys my story. Thank you, gentlemen.